I'll tell you something that's a lot worse. And that is all of those people who are so busy being what they are in terms of the old Adam. They have settled for being junk. They have no eschatological vision of what God wants to do with them, so they're not at all in danger of hypocrisy. I think the church has been intimidated about it by a lot of that bunk, to be honest with you. I think the church must learn better how to respond to that kind of thing. Fourthly, dollars, cents, and nonsense. You know what I did when I got a call from this parish? They came and told me what they were going to pay me. We got off on a good foot right away. I knew the two guys, not well, but had met them before. And I said, Tolly and Charlie, I said, you really don't want me for your pastor. You're looking for a discount guy. You'll have to go to somebody else. But I said, you know, I think I'd like to be your pastor, but not a discount pastor. And, you know, they laughed about it and went to work on it. And they knew, on the one hand, I wasn't being greedy. But they didn't come to me with any kind of pride or any kind of feeling good about what they were offering. And then they came again and, you know, said, and finally after a time I said, sure, that's fine. And, but they said, you know, we don't feel good about this. We want to do better, and if at the end of the year we can in any way, we'll do it. Well, I didn't think much of that. I didn't expect anything. At the end of the year, when I met with the personnel committee about, it was, I guess, on the 30th of December or whatever, they handed me an envelope, and here was a check. Because they said, we said we'd try to do better, and we did. And here it is. Now, the first thing we want to know is, how is your job going for you? What do you want us to know about what you're doing? I find that parishioners are very often embarrassed at what they do in relation to their pastors financially. They don't feel good about that. And they probably, they deserve to feel bad. But they need to be challenged sometimes to do very, very much better. I wish that by and large I saw more clergy willing to address some of these things more explicitly. I don't have any hesitations in talking about money matters very directly with the appropriate people, namely in our instance of the personnel committee. And I don't have any problems preaching about worldly goods because it's one of the major topics of the New Testament, one of the major problems in modern society. And I don't buy any of the theology that says that riches is a blessing from God. It may or may not be a blessing from God, but were I running the show as God is and I wanted to judge people, I would guess that I could bring their lives into a situation of severe judgment by making them rich. So that the giving of goods would be the surest way to drive people into misery. And I say that with a history of having worked at a research institute raising funds and having sat with five people gathered around the table whose assets exceeded $1 billion. And I can tell you about the richest one, where both members of the family, mother and father, were alcoholics. Thank God they have been redeemed and now support one of the greatest alcoholic recovery centers in the nation. There's a lot of intimidation, a lot of internal wasting away that goes on, it seems to me, at that level. There are several other things. One of the most difficult things about parish ministry is to maintain the inner life, prayer, and what one might refer to as spiritual life. The need to have a center of who one is in relationship to God, a core from which one can minister, substance from which one can minister, substance from which one gets theological courage, from which one can draw an enormous kind of love. Prayer that enables us to become useless, for prayer is to enter into a kind of uselessness before God, so that God can, as a matter of fact, minister. God is the minister, and he ministers through us. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. And one, this year, I tried during the Lenten season something that was helpful. Not everyone has this opportunity, but I spent a half a day at the monastery St. John's Monastery. In the monastery itself, very close to the community, having worked there, one half morning each week during Lent, to try to make sure that some of that time I was being very, very useless in terms of productivity, and trying to live gracefully. Gee whiz, am I supposed to quit now? That's gone on a long time. Now you probably want to shoot all that down, and I didn't even give you a chance.
Can you wrap it up?
I can stop right there, and I can simply wrap it up by saying that parish ministry has come to me to be a very enormous kind of privilege. I'm glad that the Lord was patiently, you know, provided ways for me to get into it ultimately. And that it is also a very difficult kind of task, challenging kind of task. There are other kinds of things that could be discussed very fruitfully. Family life in parish ministry is a very difficult kind of thing to deal with at times. But that's really what I have to say, and I don't know if it's helpful to anybody else or not. But if you want to discuss it, you can eat the second sitting, and I suppose I could too. Or if you want to just nail me and, you know, darken my orbs, as this one lady used to say up at the, one guy used to tell his wife up at the northwest angle. She was a smoker, rolled her own, and laid the cigarette right on her lips, and she'd talk terribly fast, and it would hang her and go up and down. Never touched any one of her three teeth. He told her to behave or he'd darken her orbs. Any questions or refutations or anything? No offense to Professors Wendell. Yes?
I was hoping that you'd touch a little bit more on your personal family life in relationship to the members within the congregation. We read so many articles about pastors and loneliness, and I was kind of interested in that.
Mm-hmm. I read an article about loneliness written by a bishop in our church, and I checked it out with a number of pastors, and most all of the, everyone that I talked to, who was towards about six, thought it was a bunch of bunk.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a magnification, as far as I can tell, about the loneliness, and it grows out of the fact that there is a refusal to recognize at times that loneliness is something that is experienced by everyone. And one of the problems that we have about loneliness is usually that we haven't learned how to ever live alone or live in solitude. So that loneliness becomes a traumatic experience. Maybe by definition, loneliness is a negative thing. There is a certain kind of loneliness that is present in terms of parish ministry, reflected in not being quite sure as to how close you can get to some people. But I have discovered that the laity are worthy of far more trust than I think they're usually invested in them. I don't bear the most difficult problems of the parish ministry alone. I don't dare mention a couple of them because they've got great enormity. But they didn't represent any particular problem for me, but can share them readily with lay people who are able to keep confidences, who are able to surround me with support. I think some loneliness is a result of fear and anxiety and an inability to trust anybody. We have to distinguish between that loneliness, which is a part of the loneliness of the human condition, and that loneliness that comes as part of the parish ministry. I was in many ways lonelier as a teacher, professor, and then the loneliest people in the world are some people in academia. You know, we make accusations about ivory tower existence, but I tell you the amount of the expressions of love that sometimes exist in academic communities are so minimal, it's unbelievable. And I found always a ministry outside of my classroom, an administrative ministry as a layperson, was a ministry of loving many fellow faculty members. I say that so strongly because it has to be held in perspective. I think that at some points we've encouraged kind of a self-pity because of a lack of awareness about the loneliness of the human condition. And I can vouch for that because I have done some of those things that lead to lonely experiences. You think it isn't lonely to go to East Germany alone, or to live 3 months apart from your wife, or 6 months, as Wendell has done, and so on? Believe me, that is a lonely experience that can lead to loneliness. A loneliness occurs, I think, at a spiritual level, very frequently because of not trusting one's people.
We had a loneliness problem in the parish, mainly that there wasn't enough of it.
You weren't alone enough.
We had a lack of loneliness, and that was a key problem. seriously, people were surprised when we'd finally have a night off and not go somewhere, and to have a night to be able to stay home was significant. I do think that part of it is often a real ambiguity about how much can you trust parishioners and how much they can trust you. In seminary, very often we're trained to be both prophets and priests, and there's almost a feeling that to be a prophet you have to stand against the congregation and be kind of intentionally lonely. And somehow or other, if you have too much relationship with the congregation, you're forfeiting some of your own integrity and so on and so forth. That puts a strange kind of paradox, in the guts of many pastors.
In some parishes, of course, without question, are more difficult than others. It is helpful to find some people that are especially sensitive to what your ministry might be like. One of the things, for example, that has been really helpful for me is the fact that in our parish is one of my old college classmates who also went through seminary but now is a mathematics professor. Well, you know, he knows something about my life in a certain kind of way that a lot of other people don't. But I have got a real responsibility. One of my major responsibilities also as a pastor in this parish is to make sure that when I leave it, those people are better educated about what my role as a pastor is. So I tell them a lot of things about what I'm up to and doing. You can't tell everybody, but you know, that report to the church council can be more than just, you know, what are we going to do about financing this here problem? You know, people can, they don't sometimes know, you know, and I tell them, I'm sorry, my father died. You have to allow me now in the next 2-3 months even, those days when I can't cope with some things, and I'm going to go home. Or, you know, if you can't get through to me someday, it's because I just got to be alone. Sorry about that, but that's the way it is. I need time to grieve. It hurts. You know? Now, I could have gone by and said, oh, I am just a big, tough guy. Jesus makes me tough. You know, you will never see me shed any tears. You know? But then what would I have robbed them of? They wouldn't know what I'm like. Neither would I. I hope I wasn't hard on you in that response. No. You know, that it wasn't any other kind.
Just can't stand hurt people.
What? Yeah, I
can't. It still would be interesting to me also to hear some kind of commentary on the pastor's family and the pastor's kid phenomenon and how they relate not only to their own parish but to the community in general.
I can tell you how one of our children, and he's here, please don't get into any kind of conversation. Don't ever go up to him, so you're the one, please. There are some difficult things that developed there. First Sunday, I think I was in the parish, our son who was about 5 then, maybe 6, chose one of the members, was standing out on the back steps with him, and he said, say, I'll race you to the car out there. He said, I don't want to race you to the car. And he says, oh, come on, I'll race you to the car. He says, okay, I'll race you to the car. So he says, and my son says, I'll count. I'll say, get ready, get set, go. So he counted, get ready, get set, turned around, kicked the other guy in the shins and said, go. And he was out of the car and he was hopping around 1 foot. Now, fortunately, it was the husband of the church secretary. uh, wasn't any great problem. One of the things that we have done that has been very helpful, we're more fortunate than many because we live 8 miles from the church. They never bothered me for keys, none of those things. But another thing that we adopted as a very specific policy in terms of the interview for call is that my wife made it clear and I reinforced it, and it went back and forth like that, that she's not the associate pastor. But that doesn't mean that she isn't terribly supportive and is not interested in the parish. That can be carried to another kind of extreme, but that happened in the call, the interview process. Then another thing is that we established by written things and so on, is that no communications would be received by me through either my children or my wife, unless there were emergencies, you know, through home by notes that might be left by telephone. But if they had something that they wanted to say about my parish ministry, they don't have to go and talk to my wife. They can come and talk to me. Because they put an enormous burden if they try to communicate through them. Then if they forget to tell me, then I'm angry at my family. So we've worked hard at that, made explicit mention of that at annual meetings about what our family relationship, what our expectations are, and have found that to be very, very helpful. Made a world of difference, and it was a long time before the parishioners knew where our kids were. There was a peculiar kind of anonymity. And we haven't found any enormous expectations made in the parish itself. Sometimes a little bit in the school because I happen to be a relatively public figure in the community. And the other thing is different is that our children, two of them, are really not PKs. You know, they were pretty well on life's way before I ever became a preacher. So it's a little bit hard to tell. You know, I don't know. The worst thing is the amount of the little time, by comparison, the more demands on my life and so on, so that I don't spend as much time. Though on the other hand, I have come to view that a bit differently as a result of what I see among parishioners. Mm-hmm. Because I know guys that work from, you know, to get home, to work 8-hour days. They come home, put their butts on a sofa, and sit and watch television. Now, if being home in the body is such an enormously important dimension, there are some of them who should never have any problems with their children. But I see their children.
I think the only one in the ministry you have an associate pastor or intern? Or
we have an intern.
Mm-hmm. 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 How large is your parish?
1,000 baptized. Mm-hmm. It's a high, because of a high level of lay involvement, it's a very demanding parish. But there, most of the agreements that we make within the parish about work, you know, if I'm going to do 25 meetings in homes, for example, then the committees know that they don't have to expect me at their meetings, and they are going to participate very strongly, extra strongly, in running their activities for that quarter of the year or whatever. They don't have to look for much pastoral help. But usually the high level of explicitness about that is very, very helpful.
I was going to ask about a professor at seminary that said he's noticed a disturbing trend towards ministers being lone wolves, running their own show, being the prima donna, not cooperating with other ministers in the area. And mm-hmm. One of the examples was he assigned a paper in which he put three people on one paper, so each of us would only have to write 3 pages. And we all ended up writing our own 10-page draft, mm-hmm. so that there wasn't much cooperation there. On internship, we got together with Lutheran pastors, and I found even though we had the same language, mm-hmm. there was a great deal of jealousy, a great deal of bragging about my program this, my program that, and that actually there was more sharing. Well, in my case, with a Methodist pastor and a Catholic priest, we get together and we didn't seem to be as threatened, mm-hmm. sharing ideas on doing this and that and the other thing. Mm-hmm. Do you find that to be a trend, and what do you think can be done to...
I don't think it's a trend. I think that's always existed. As far as I know, my experience as an adult layman has told me that it's no different right now than it was 20 years ago, or 30 years ago. And I have much more sympathy for that now. That isn't necessarily because people want to be prima donnas. Or it isn't necessarily. It's because a parish, particularly when it becomes a certain kind of size, is a very, very independent kind of unit. And one of my very painful experiences has been to work for more cooperation and not to find it works out. It's hard for me to comment on that because, you know, there are very specific people involved. But I think there really is some truth to that. One of the hardest things to maintain and to establish, or establish and maintain, are very deep relationships to one's fellow Lutheran clergy. And I'm not sure, there's so many factors that go into that, that it's really hard to describe. One of the major factors is the fact that pastors have relatively little time for socializing. Our family, for example, right now finds, because we have children, one of whom is 18 years old, another one who's 16, another one who's 14. When it really comes to a fine social evening, our kids provide us with an enormous amount of stimulus. We provide us with an enormous community experience. And if I had to make a choice between spending some time with a pastor's family and our family, I guess I'd opt in, almost unfortunately in some senses, just for our family. And it's gotten more complicated now because there are so few instances in life where you can find that, say, the four principles of two unions can get along with any kind of depth experience. I might get along very well with a fellow pastor, but wives may not have anything in common, or one may not have anything in common with anybody else beyond. So that's a complicating thing too. There, it's more than pettiness and more than jealousy.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think part of it might be though due to the fact that we tend to take the corporate model for our image.
Explain that a little bit, Jay. And I think
you're. It seems to me that we. As pastors tend to view ourselves out of the corporate model and as the chief executive,
mm-hmm.
and we're running competing organizations,
mm-hmm.
we get caught up in that whole success syndrome that
right.
goes along with the corporate
right.
model.
Mm-hmm.
We get caught up in that whole imagery. I was going to question you, I'm sorry I've been in and out, but
mm-hmm.
On the salary thing, for example, I really like the idea of straight talk on salary, but I've been wrestling with the notion that that maybe we're at a place in history where, pastors, it's important to begin to develop a different lifestyle
mm-hmm.
that runs counter to the culture,
mm-hmm.
runs counter to the corporate image.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that's done, obviously, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that's... Yeah, it sounds tremendous. I can really lay out some piety on that makes it tremendously persuasive, But no, I really do feel we're caught up in that.
Right.
And it generates the prima donna
yeah.
attitude that I think is there.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my experience.
I think it is there. I agree. You know, there's an interesting article in one of the recent issues of Lutheran Forum about a guy who from Texas who went up and got a call from a congregation. And they wanted him very, very much. And they offered him double what his present salary was. And he told him he didn't want the call. I thought, this guy's crazy. So he began to pile on more on the fringe benefits. And he said he didn't want the call. There is a real dimension that parish people have to come to terms with the pastor exercising a kind of stewardship, but also where they cannot justify their non-sacrificial lifestyles
mm-hmm.
as a call from God. If God will keep him humble, they'll keep him poor. But there is some sense in which, and this guy, he made his real point was this. He says that a lot of pastors have moved into the upper middle class, and they are indeed for sale. The reason that I could talk to those people about that call, I don't know if you were in here when I said,
yeah.
you're looking, is because I was not for sale.
Yeah.
And in the straightforward talk is an indication, indeed, I am worth this, but I am not for sale. You know, and don't ever try that tactic or we're going to have problems. And this guy made a very significant, I'd want to see every seminarian that's going into the parish soon to read it. I gave it immediately to the intern because he said, I don't know if we can enter any longer out of what's happening in terms of moving up into the middle, upper middle class, whether we can have any pastors or prophets. He said, it used to be said of pastors that because they were poor, they were domesticated. They were sold. He said, that's nonsense. He says, it's pastors who have got so much to hang on to, so much to lose, who are silent. And a lot of, you know, you begin to look around. It's when, I am no hero, don't misunderstand me about that matter of, you know, that drop in salary. But by virtue of having done that, that created a peculiar kind of freedom in relation to this whole thing. Because it said, well, this guy is coming to service not because we're paying him the most money. Now, you know, they have made every effort to be exceedingly generous, you know, on the basis of a variety of things.
Well, it's interesting. There's an interesting study on the Puritans. City of Pine Hill does a historical development of the covenanted community as they experienced it in New England,
mm-hmm.
and then as it developed in the Westward Movement, and how it was the kind of strength of this nation, for example, as people left the covenanted community, the East made the Westward Movement, they reestablished a small town, and the whole notion of covenanted community, a small town, as being a vital force. And then, with the Industrial Revolution and the rise of capitalism, the emergence of the middle class, capital,
mm-hmm.
was the point of decline.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there isn't, in that historical trend, a statement for the church, mm-hmm. especially for the clergy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're...
That I really feel
class captivity of the clergy or something.
Yeah, I really have some anxiety about that. I have anxiety first of all for myself.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, what I worry about is that I might find myself freer by virtue of having done something else and by virtue of knowing that I do know right now that there are three or four other ways that I can make a living. And so I want to be sure that I can make a life out of being a pastor, but it isn't just making a living.
But making a living also has some specific content to us. Specific content.
Yes.
It does suggest a certain economic level. It mm-hmm. does, you know, I think there's a captivity in that for mm-hmm. many of us. I'm not saying for you, but...
Well,
but
don't exempt me very generously, please.
I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm.
Making a living today has some specific content, mm-hmm. I think, for many of us, mm-hmm. and I think that content has to be reexamined.
Mm-hmm. This is a very problematical area because those old style preachers that I admire that were out there in North Dakota when they were very, very poor, there was a prophetic quality about their ministry that I find very little of today. And I'm probably more disturbed about some of the fear and anxiety about risk running among clergy than almost anything else. Yep.
That's just an area that fascinates me. It came up through your course. Seems to me that a lot of homework needs to be done in this.
I don't understand what kind of lifestyle you're suggesting.
I don't either.
Well, yeah. Can you be a bit more specific? Are you suggesting that the pastor should return to the more humble kind of...
Intentionally, I think I am, yes. I don't know quite how that can be accomplished. That's why it's easy to talk about and rather glib, I suppose, or fast. But it seems to me that... that one of the problems of our culture is that we're so caught up in that thing,
mm-hmm.
in that upward mobility, in that mm-hmm. all the trappings,
mm-hmm.
that we need to rediscover the way one can live simply.
So you feel that you get back to that by reducing the temptation. It seems mm-hmm. to me that the assumption is that the more a pastor is paid, that one is automatically going to move up into the, you know, into a particular lifestyle.
I think ideally I would say no.
Yeah, I mean, what about the pastor that wants to make his sacrifice, his offering to the church, or to the NAACP, or to environmental causes, or whatever? Doesn't that individual have that right to do that? And I think the question is one of, you know, maybe value and worth are two different, I wouldn't use them synonymously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that it's hard to estimate what a pastor's value is,
mm-hmm.
Just like it is for a layperson. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some standards in terms of worth,
mm-hmm.
in terms of compare, even if we're so, you know, pragmatic as to use other, you know, other professionals with comparable mm-hmm. education or something like that.
But that's mm-hmm. buying in the model. Mm-hmm. That's buying into the model.
All right.
I have a
right.
question about that.
I can see that. Mm-hmm. But see, my question is, it seems to me it's not the money, it's how the money is used.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those are two different issues.
Yeah. But
the money is buying into the model. And then the second question is stewardship.
Yeah, I think the stewardship question has to be really kept in there very strongly. That's
always in there.
Yeah.
That's always in there. You can be poor and be a horrible steward.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that question is always alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the prior question is a question of model.
Mm-hmm. Because there are several concerns that are hanging together here, it seems as though the way out of this one is not to let the congregation off the hook that they shouldn't pay you.
No.
But it seems to me that I've been struggling with this one, is to come to some point where you say, this is where my lifestyle stops, and anything that I earn hereafter is going to be given away. And I'm really thrilled over one particular parishioner that is in the former Lutheran Church. You know, he's the only person I guess I've ever really heard say where it's convincing, you know, I have enough. Not very well off, but I have enough. And but one of the things we have to stop doing is what I said in terms of a theology of money, is to stop talking about this, you know, just sharing your blessings. I don't believe all this stuff is blessing. I believe that God may well be using money to exercise his judgment upon enormous amounts of people. That money is as ambiguous in terms of something that, if I can learn to receive it as gift, and then that implies, of course, enormous things for stewardship. I think stewardship is one of the most beautiful things the church has got going for it. Pastors have every reason to be very explicit about that in their own life and in relation to the congregation. We can relate it to so many things. And you know, it's one of the most unique features we've got going in terms of the whole church.
I had a professor say that it was amazing to him that each new call that he took was a raise in salary.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but that seems to be the trend in the church. He,
mm-hmm.
he said that's one of the symbols in a very non-success-oriented profession, mm-hmm. that seems to show mm-hmm. a move up the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I would like to knock that, but he said, when I thought back, every new call I took was a raise in salary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned something like having a pool where everyone is paid exactly the same in the ministry. But he doesn't know what that would do in terms of devastating the person who does have that ego edge,
mm-hmm.
who is a little bit tied into that, and yet on the other hand is a highly motivated Christian servant, but has that particular need.
Yeah. And then there are other kinds of factors that are at stake. You know, maybe if I want to work harder and be compensating more and spend it to go to East Germany because that's a different kind of ministry, then what? You know, it's a very difficult thing. One of the things that I think, I don't know if it was you, Wendell, when you were at St. John's or whatever, whether there couldn't be a little bit more justice at least when it comes to retirement.
We argued in the South Pacific District out of our conference to normalize all pensions,
uh-huh.
with the only factor being longevity, uh-huh. one variable being longevity. Of course, it's confronted by the clergy,
uh-huh.
communist inspired.
Uh-huh. I can remember tail ending on that, when Berkheimer was head of the pensions, he came to talk to the seniors at the seminary and was asked to explain the pension program. His words were, this is the church's way of thanking your servants. I can also remember one of my peers responding, well, it seems to us that some servants are thanked a little bit more than others. We just, the way it's figured on your
on your salary. We just buried Christian Iverson here a couple months ago, and 45 years in the ministry and a pension of $160 a month.
Mm-hmm.
It was because of him that I got fired up about seeing if there wasn't something that could be done.
Yeah. You could tell us those stories about some of those people that have retired at Luther Seminary with pensions, you know, that are not much, not as good as that. That are just, you know, it's an insult.
You know, the ones that fought the notion the most, those who had the largest salaries going now,
yeah,
and who had the largest pension coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, see, that points to the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Raising my salary.
Mm-hmm.
Body into the system.
Mm-hmm.
She has some more perspective to share. I don't know where.
Well, I don't know. I guess maybe I'm speaking mostly out of defense for my dad, because I don't think he's bought into the system, as you say. But he did get up in front of his council and say, according to that
guidelines.
Yeah, those guidelines or whatever. I'm worth such and such, this much money, because of his experience and all of that business.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, I think the reason he did that was the perspective of this retirement that is coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also an educating of those people that mm-hmm. they weren't paying mm-hmm. their pastor what mm-hmm.
That's the difference between when he was saying that he wasn't going to be bought.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between that and what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Cause, well, yeah, and Dad, if you don't want to pay this mm-hmm. to me, then I'll just go.
There's an interesting thing that happened to me in this that you might be kind of might shed a little light as to what can happen in terms of the administration of the church. I think it was the district office that for all of those years in graduate school, for 7 years of college teaching and administration, they were going to put me on those salary guidelines. They asked me, gave me an equivalency of 3 years of experience. You know, I, at a human level, I had to endure a rather enormous assault on my ego to become a parish pastor. Now, I don't feel sorry for me, please. But in retrospect, you know, I could really be angry about some of that nonsense. Now, the only thing I'd say in the parish about that, I understood what their budgetary problem was. But I said, I will never continue at that level if it means that you are asking me to sacrifice so that you don't have to give anything. It's a nonsense. That's silly. That'd be the most dishonest man in your presence in terms of what the Christian realities are.
But pushing through in that anger, I think, is where the where some of the exciting answers reside, rather than just get angry at it and then react against it.
Mm-hmm.
Push it through something redemptive.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of where the issue seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
Angry at the system that develops this kind of value system.
Mm-hmm.
That puts it on the line of its way. It needs to be addressed.
Yeah, we need to develop a profound appreciation. I think of, you know, I always have two pastors in mind, both of whom are godparents for our children, who, one of whom went into ministry also rather late in life, but had to go 7 years through college and seminary with four children. Started out like Jesus did as a carpenter. And what I have admired about those men particularly has been the enormous faithfulness of their lives in parish ministry. And I see that at so many levels. I can begin to name them one after another. The only word to use to describe their ministry is faithfulness. Also competent, you know, we can start into that, but faithfulness is the Christian attribute to use to describe that. And what is so distressing is that there's a sense in which all of this other kind of stuff is calculated along another, there's another calculus that is operative. And that's for me, causes an awful lot of anguish. You know, what if I moved from a Tomo Lutheran church to a smaller parish for less money? You know, then I'll have to go through all that again. I failed, I suppose. But, you know, there is something about this.
Yeah.
Almost not to have the desire to move, for example, to a big congregation is, what's wrong with you, kind of. You know.
See, that's where I was really appreciative of your use of the word obedience. You know, Philippians 2, we've been wrestling with that for years in this morning.
Right.
And, you know, have this mind among you which you have in Christ Jesus.
Jesus.
You know, that whole notion, their understanding of power, right? It's a different, there's something very different there that we are not at home with, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now that's, of course, I am convinced in much of our, in much of the way the church relates itself to the social order at the present time, is that we have failed to offer a model of that which the society needs most, namely a model of redemptive suffering. And even as I approach the abortion question, I am very, very convinced that one of the tragedies of that whole thing is that we buy into the fastest, most immediate possible solutions for those things that might potentially be very, very painful. We are so now oriented, so oriented in terms of our senses, so oriented in terms of that, too much of that immediate gratification, which I kind of am taken by surprise. But to talk in terms of obedience and deferred gratification and looking to God for rewards, I guess one of the reasons I went to East Germany is because it's one of the few models that I can experience where something is being shown to me that's an absolute and utter shock. Scares the pants off of me and says there's something wrong where I'm living. Something wrong about the way I'm hearing the gospel. Contrary to what some people say, I do think we are living in a church of enormously cheap grace. Well, it's time to eat, huh? Eat, huh?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jack.
Oh, it's been fun to do this. So much fun to do something that's kind of been brewing on one for a long time, and you just need to have somebody get a red poker at you a little bit, and then you have to do it, and it's done.
Are we going to hear from a professor later this week?
That's up to you. Yeah. You will hear from him, but you will hear from a pastoral professor if you hear from Wendell Frericks, I guarantee you. Yeah.
Would you go into a little bit, you made a passing remark about the exaltation of the clergy, or exaltation
of laity,
and you talked about, you used the expression pure and utter nonsense. It was in the context, it seems to me, of an authoritarian model and an enabling model, and you used an example of representation. I don't know if it was at a district convention.
Oh yeah, as though.
I'm not sure what you meant.
Okay, there is a. It goes on at in the American Lutheran Church about representation at large, because we have, say, half clergy, half laity, and it also goes on at our district convention, where if you are a pastor of a parish, you are automatically a voting delegate. So that we get a lot of discussions that go on, and at times. I would not mind the discussion if it started to say, how can the church best be represented? And then we were to discuss whether or not clergy really represent the church, and so on and so on and so on. But each time there is something that comes up about trying to change that without any kind of rationale being used. And the only thing that I can find is the common ingredient is kind of it has, it smacks of a triumphalism of the laity and a put down of the clergy, as though I, as a pastor, would not represent the interests of the laity of this congregation. As it creates a dichotomy that I really don't think exists in terms of the representation of the congregation. Now, I'm not saying that maybe it shouldn't be the case that two-thirds of the representatives are from the laity and one-half from the clergy. But there is something that is, there's something unrealistic about some of the discussions that I have been in.
Out West is a little different. And Southern California is an exaltation of the clergy. And a diminishing of the capabilities of the laity more. Is it still the idea that the hair pastor is the one with the moxie?
Well, I think that there's sometimes that exists among the lay people, but I think that sometimes among the clergy, it's reverse. I don't find an awful lot of that. Unless my perceptions are wrong.
Well, it may be reasonable too.
I really don't run into many, unless you want to accuse me of having it so much or something. I don't really run into many people that are terribly the old authoritarian type and want to exalt the office and so on. I think I've encountered often something else, and it may have something to do with where we are in terms of the society as to how churched it is and so on.
We're much more conservative in the West, though, than you are.
It's possible. I can't comment about that because I just don't know. Probably because you're in a society that is experiencing more turmoil in some sense, so that the last place of anchorage and stability is the church. Not to recognize that at times, of course, is to create the worst kinds of problems. You know, there is a stability that God does give, that it's only within stability that change can occur. Is that helpful to you? I don't know. I think that's where I made that remark. I could give some specific cases. I sensed it when I was on the board at Golden Valley Lutheran College, and some of the moves toward representation were, without question, you know, it was kind of assumed that, well, automatically to change the clergy lay ratio of representation on the board would be such a fantastic move. And I sense it in other ways, where there's a desire, you know, to make sure that in the worship service, you know, we're not giving the laity their due unless they read the lessons, and, you know, let's just get a little white gown for them or something. I don't really believe that that's necessarily involved in kind of making sure that lay people really are significant in the church. I respect those lay people most of all when I share with them the deepest and toughest problems of the parish and say, brethren, this is a part of the burden that I have as your pastor. I ask you to carry it with me. Not, you know, to have them reading the epistle on Sunday morning and not to share those kinds of things seem to me to be ridiculous. And yet that's the shape that some of it has taken, it seems to me.
So then the question has to do with function. How one views the function of the clergy, how one views the function of the laity, and on the basis of that, you come into this scheme of exaltation or plateau or whatever.
Well, I remember one time planning a sesquicentennial observance, the Norwegian sesquicentennial, was that it? And, you know, a couple of clergy refused to participate in a procession with, you know, robes and all that stuff because that was an exaltation of clergy. I thought, nonsense. You could have, you know, the laity were absolutely thrilled about some of that stuff, and that isn't, you know, necessarily a setting apart that is silly. I spent too much time in Italy to see the joys and glories also of some ceremony, and that it can be very exalting and exciting. You know, and I think that was a time where, you know, didn't want to be identified with that clergy role at all. Seemed to me, to be very honest, kind of silly.
But what you're saying, though, is really separating the laity and the clergy, too. That you don't want them up there reading the lesson, or do you have people, lay people?
Well, I didn't say I didn't want them up there reading the lessons. No, I'm simply saying that if it is assumed that that's, you know, represents an exaltation of the lay status, not necessarily so at all. It might be a kind of a external accommodation that is a frustrated way of trying to introduce them to the chancel area which has been reserved for the clergy, and then for sure I'm getting the laity into their status. It is a little bit hard to differentiate there. But I don't think that's ultimately to exalt the laity. It could possibly be a part of it. I don't see any great merit to having lay people stand up and read poorly. You know, You know, they may be. We don't do that in our parish. We read the epistle always in unison. But lay people,
we don't do it in ours either.
The lay people, one of the things we do, however, is that the lay people read the prayers. This tradition is assigned to the clergy. I just ask so-and-so to read this petition, and you read this petition, you read that petition. They always read that because Lutherans are so afraid of praying in public that they just about die. That this is probably to help them move in that direction. And then to give view to the fact that intercession rises out from the body of Christ in this particular way, rather than having them bounce from their pews up into the chancel and thus participate in the Holy of Holies.
It does make you nervous, though, that it's the one profession that anybody can do. I mean, they always talk as though anybody can preach.
Yeah, right.
As though there's no training, there's no... I don't know, every time I hear, I'm not going to say every time, but for the most part, when laymen think that all you have to do to preach is just to stand up mm-hmm. and spill off the top of your mm-hmm. head, what you hear is a lot of personal testimony
mm-hmm.
that is a terrible mixture of bad theology and, you know, some mm-hmm. sincerity that comes mm-hmm. through as verifying the bad theology. And mm-hmm. after a while, you know, you say, well, what are you going to say next time? And next time, you know, or are you going to use the gospel as a springboard that you're really going to struggle with and try to relate that to your mm-hmm. experience, or are you just going to put the stamp of approval on anything that happens to me then becomes some form of theology that needs to be shared? Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that, you know, you have clergy up here and you have laity down here, but it's definitely a role. That's mm-hmm. why we send people to be trained, so that mm-hmm. we don't eat garbage, so that we are edified. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it a question of, hesitate to use the term probability, but in a sense, any Christian can preach, just as in a sense, any Christian can perform surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want any Christian to take my appendix out, mm-hmm. and I don't think, you know, you would either. And so, but it's more likely that I'm going to survive, and what's going to be done for me is better for someone that has training, has skill in that.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have a closer approximation of the truth.
Mm-hmm. But almost is exactly parallel, because the person saying, yeah, I think I know where the appendix is.
Mm-hmm.
How about you let me take care of it?
Yeah.
You know, you can think twice about it, but when it's the gospel and it's something, love and grace and all those sweet things like forgiveness, why, anybody can talk about that.
Yeah. But the trouble of it is, it isn't that easy either, because the division is not just in terms of skill. Because that reality with which we deal is that which is not necessarily accessible on the basis of skill. There are all kinds. If it depended on skill and exegesis, you know, those guys that I think of, some of those lumberjacks, I think of lay people that, you know, don't know any more about all sorts of things. But their expression of the faith is so profound that as a matter of fact, they can announce with profound effectiveness. That is unnerving. Why should it be on the one hand? Because that's the reality. Luther never said that it's going to be the seminary professors that are going to be those who exemplify the faith. You know, I was visiting with Wendell. As a matter of fact, I'd have to say to you in all candor, in all of my experience in academia, particularly in the area of theology and so on, I find almost an inverse relationship between academic skills and keeping the faith. Boire would be the last guy that could ever say it's because of those skills that they're keeping the faith, or that they're even an aid in keeping the faith.
And that's really your goal, is to help people to articulate the faith.
And keep the faith.
Yeah.
I have to admire those people who are just tremendously faithful, not just those who are skilled.
Isn't it the case that the more educated one becomes, the more inclination there is to abstract? You know, if there's levels of abstraction in our language, in our thinking, that it's very difficult to remind yourself of where the roots are, and that academia doesn't become a you know, it's a means to something that it doesn't become a goal, and that one has to constantly remind oneself of that.
See, correct exegesis may or may not result in a good sermon.
Well, as a layperson, I really disagree with what you said, because, you know, Sunday morning after Sunday morning, listening to sermons, you can tell when your minister has prepared well or whether he hasn't. And you really, when I go to worship, I look forward to a well-prepared message that I'm going to be able to go on the rest of the week. So I know a lot of people would be scared to death to get up and preach. They would have no basis whatsoever because they wouldn't be able to stand up.
I think that would be the person I would be inclined to ask. If you're going to do a personal testimony thing, I'd be inclined to ask the lumberjack, who probably would be a little bit reticent, rather than the person that says, boy, have I got something to say. Just give me a forum, because that's generally, you know,
the
other
minister
time.
Does have, I mean, at least in my church, the minister is looked upon as, you know, one who's giving us God's word.
I'm not supporting poorly prepared preachers.
No, but it sounded like, you know, you thought.
Well, I think there are some skills.
Can I just break in 1 second? I liked what she just said. The people are looking at the minister as one who is giving or proclaiming, let's say, God's word. What I feel about, what I become worried about in this matter of exalting the laity or whatever, is I sense at times that that's exactly the kind of thing that would make a pastor just incredibly nervous and fumble all over the place, that that'd be too much exalting of the pastor. Nonsense. That's exactly what I find lay people expect, and it's not a wrong expectation. And I ought not to, you know, in order to exalt the laity, say, well, gee, I haven't really got much to say. God hasn't really called me much. Let's just make sure that we could get the lay people, but then we'd really get God's word. No, that's an awesome kind of responsibility, and if I better own up to it.